I'm vacuuming at Mrs. Driggs the next day when my phone vibrates in my pocket. I pull it out and recognize the 206 area code, but the call has already gone to voicemail. A few seconds later, it chimes to let me know there's a message waiting. I stare at my phone in my palm, the vacuum motor whining. Why did he call back? Does he even know it was me who called him? Who knows if he even saved my number, and my outgoing voicemail message is now generic in case all underscore BS calls. Whatever he has to say, who is this or something else, I don't want to hear it. I go to delete the voicemail, but I hesitate. And in that moment, the phone rings again, and I'm relieved and ashamed in equal measures. Hey, I say, my heart pounding. There's a slight pause on the line. Repeat, says the voice. The vacuum cleaner is still on, and it takes me a minute to understand that it's not Ben. I flip the phone over to check the caller ID. It's not the 206 number this time. It's blocked. Repeat, the voice says again, and then I understand I'm not being asked to repeat anything. Yes. Do you know who this is? I know. What's that noise? Oh, I'm at work. He chuckles. As am I. His voice is not what I expected. It's jovial, almost comforting. It's like we already know each other. The vacuum is still droning. I turn it off. There, is that better? Yes. He chuckles again. If only I could turn off the noise at my work so easily. But I found a quiet corner. Forgive the delay. I listen then. In the background, there's an electric clang of something. Cash registers? One must choose the risks one takes and mitigate them. Yes, I say. Speaking of risks and choices, you have chosen?
Yes, I say.
That's very brave, he says.
I'm scared.
It flies out, this absolute truth. All underscore BS seems to pull it from me, which is an irony of sorts. He continues, you know what George Patton said? All intelligent men are frightened. The more intelligent they are, the more they are frightened. That holds true for women, too, I'd say.
I don't say anything.
Have you decided on a method? He asks.
Yes, I'm going to...
Don't.
He cuts me off.
That's a personal decision.
Oh, sorry. I'm not just disappointed. I'm devastated. I want to tell him so badly.
Are all your affairs in order?
Affairs in order. That's the language one of the sites he referred me to used. It had all the instructions about writing the note, creating a legally binding will. Yes, I answer. I feel dazed.
Remember, the opposite of bravery is not cowardice, but conformity. You are bucking conformity, choosing your own path.
Somewhere it registers that Meg would have loved this sentiment if he used it on her. She was all about bucking conformity, right up to the very end.
Now, like all things, it's a matter of following through. Screw your courage.
To the sticking place. I finish the sentence without thinking. There's a pause on the line. Something is being weighed. I've made a mistake. Then I hear a burst of commotion as the ambient background noise clangs through the phone, electronic bleeping and the clatter of change. It's the sound of slot machines. Lots of them. A sound I recognize from the Indian casinos.
The door was locked.
I hear him bark. His own voice different now.
Sorry, Smith. Lock's been busted for weeks.
There's the sound of a door slamming, and the noise goes quiet again.
We should wrap this up, he says in a formal tone. Best of luck to you.
Wait, I say. I want him to send me the stuff I found in Meg's trash, the encrypted documents, the checklist, more evidence, more proof to hang him with. But he's gone. Chapter 29. That night, I call Harry Kang. Harry, it's Cody.
Cody, hey.
A car horn blares, and there's a loud cacophony of people talking.
Where are you?
I ask.
In Korea, visiting my grandmother. Hold on.
I hear his phone shuffle, and then the electric ping of a doorbell. And then it's quieter.
There. I'm in a tea shop now. Seoul is nuts. What's up?
I might have enough information. Or I've gotten all I'm going to get. All underscore BS's last words echo in my ears. Best of luck. Like it was my high school graduation we were discussing. Or like he knew it was the last time we'd ever speak.
What do you have?
This is what I know for sure. Actually, I don't know anything for sure. Here's what I have. I'm pretty sure he's on the West Coast somewhere. He always seems to be having dinner when I am, or things like that.
That narrows it down to a few hundred million people.
I have more. I think he might work at a casino. So, casino on the West Coast? Las Vegas?
Which has a population of, what, a million people? If he's even there. It could work anywhere in Nevada,
Harry says.
Gambling is legal statewide.
Or he could work at an Indian casino anywhere, I add.
Exactly. What else you got?
His last name might be Smith. Someone called him that.
It's helpful to have a name, even if it's the least helpful name in existence.
He pauses.
You have anything else?
No, our call got cut short.
Call? He called you?
Yeah.
Landline or cell?
I don't know. It came up as blocked. But he was at work, so I'd guess cell?
On your cell or landline?
Sal, I was at work, and we gave up our landline.
When?
Did we give up our landline?
No, Cody. When did he call you?
Earlier today.
Seriously? Harry's voice perks up.
Yeah. Why, is that bad?
Careless.
So bad for him, but good for us?
Could be.
I can tell, even through the phone, that Harry is smiling.
You'll have to give me complete access to your mobile account.
Fine.
And send everything you have on the Smith guy. Usernames. Any accounts you use to communicate. Anything you have on him. Any electronic trail. Email it all to me.
If I have to go stand outside Mrs. Chandler's driveway to pick up a Wi-Fi signal, I'll do it. Though Mrs. Banks said the library is reopening any day. Done.
And understand I'll be doing some quasi-legal things.
For a good cause, I remind him.
I'll say. I'm going a little crazy at my grandmother's, so it'll be good to have a project. I'll be in touch when I find something.
That afternoon, I stand outside the Chandler's empty house, pirating their Wi-Fi signal, and I send Harry everything. The next day, the library reopens. I go in with the laptop and check the anonymous messaging service all underscore BS and I used, but there's nothing. I check the final solution boards. But there's nothing from him there either. I am pretty certain there will be no more communication from him. But maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe I've gone from being the mouse to being the snake. After 3 days, Harry calls.
That wasn't easy, he says.
He sounds utterly thrilled. Did you find him? Harry doesn't answer. Instead, he tells me a long and complicated tale about how all underscore BS used Skype to make some kind of VOIP call. Not through a phone, but through a tablet. It's hard to trace a telephone number, but not as hard to track an application's user.
This is how even the best criminals get caught, he tells me. They are so careful, until they're not.
So you did find him?
Like I said, it wasn't easy. The tablet was registered to this guy, Alan DeForest.
So that's him?
I don't think so, Harry says. When I dug a bit deeper, this DeForest had a huge online profile. He's all over Facebook and Instagram. Lots of pictures and status updates. I figured our guy would be more secretive.
But I had this feeling. So I dug up more on DeForest and discovered where he worked. He's a pit boss at the Continental Casino. What's a pit boss?
It's like a manager, but you're missing the point, Cody. It's at a casino. Your hunch was right. It's not in Las Vegas, but Laughlin, Nevada, which is like a poor man's Vegas.
But you said you didn't think it was the DeForest guy.
Right, I still don't. For one, I thought that your guy, with all his fancy encryption methods, would be more careful than to use his own device. And second, we're looking for a Smith, right? So I hacked into the employee records at the Continental Casino and looked for people with the last name Smith. As you might have guessed, there were a lot of them. But only a couple of B Smiths.
B?
All underscore B-S.
I thought that meant all bullshit.
I did too. And it might. But guys like this who are doing bad things and keeping it secret, sometimes they still want to brag about it somehow. So I wondered if B.S. weren't his initials, especially since we already know his last name is Smith. He pauses. So I checked. There are only three B. Smiths employed by the casino. Bernadette, Becky, he stops, and Bradford.
The hair on the back of my neck stands up. Bradford?
Bradford Smith, age 52, works in the Continental Casino. There's more. I looked up his internet history and found that he pays for the premium broadband package, but unlike the DeForest guy, he leaves a very light online footprint. Fits the profile.
So that's him.
Might be.
How do we know for sure?
Would you recognize his voice?
Our one and only phone call. Brief but indelible. I think so.
Good. I got a phone number for his actual cell phone. We can call on a blocked line and conference you in. If we get voicemail, you listen to his outgoing message. If he answers, I'll pose as a telemarketer and you stay quiet. Either way, you can confirm his voice.
That's all we have to do?
Yep. Hang up, and I'll call you back and patch you in.
Now? Won't he get suspicious?
Who gets suspicious of a telemarketer?
Good point.
Okay. What should we be selling that no one wants to buy?
Harry asks. As it happens, I've worked as a telemarketer before. No one wanted supplemental life insurance, and it seems oddly fitting to try to sell it to him.
I tell Harry the script. Okay, hang up and I'll call you back and we'll do this.
When Harry calls back, the line is already ringing.
Shh,
he tells me.
The voice that picks up is gruff. Hello? Hello, I'm with Good Faith Insurance Agency.
Harry begins in a smooth voice, like he does this all the time.
The reason I'm calling is to let you know that we have drastically lowered our insurance rates in Laughlin. We would love to give you a no-obligation review and quote on your current life insurance policy. If you don't have one set up yet, I'd love to discuss this very wise investment in your future. I've already told you, I'm not interested,
he says, and hangs up. We sit there for a moment. In a triangle of silence. Me? Harry Kang? And the disconnected voice of all underscore BS. Chapter 30. Once again, I'm back at the library for research, but this time it's easier. I only have to figure out how to get to Laughlin. The hard part is over. I can't quite believe it. I've been looking for all underscore BS for weeks, and at times, it has felt like chasing a ghost. But he's here. I have an address. Last night, Harry called me once more, this time with all underscore BS's, Bradford Smith's, contact information.
You are a fucking genius, Harry Kang,
I told him.
I don't know about effing genius, but I'll take genius,
he said. And I could hear the smile in his voice once again. Thank you, Harry. Thank you so much.
No. Thank you,
he said quietly.
It was fun. But it also felt good. Like maybe I could do something for Meg.
He paused.
Are you going to the police now?
I'm not sure. I was thinking I might go there myself first. Harry went quiet.
Be careful, Cody, he said after a bit. It seems abstract when you're dealing with people online. But they are still people. And some of them are not nice people. Not the kind you ever want to be in a room with.
Sometimes you don't even need to be in the same room for the damage to be done. I'll be careful, I promised. Thank you again.
Like I said, I'm glad to do it. And it's not that hard to find someone.
Really?
Harry laughed. Maybe not for me.
And that's when I had the other idea. Do you think you might be able to track down one more person?
The Greyhound to Laughlin takes 30 hours, requires 3 transfers, and costs $300 round trip. I have the money, and I can take off the time if I need to. But when I start to contemplate 60 hours alone on the bus, I begin to feel a little sick, the darkness clawing at me. I can't do this alone, with only Bradford and Meg keeping me company. I list the people I might ask to go with me. There's no one in town. I'd never ask Tricia, and the Garcias are obviously out. The friends from school, never all that close, have fallen away. Who else? Sharon Devon? Maybe the Cascades people? Except Alice is still working at Mountain Bound. Harry is in Korea until mid-August. That leaves Stoner Richard. It's not the worst idea in the world. He's home in Boise for the summer, and that's on the way. I could catch a Greyhound to Boise, and we could drive from there. There is one other person, and as soon as I think of him, I understand that there is no other person, because he is somehow as linked up in all this as I am. His voicemail is still on my phone. I never listened to it, but I haven't deleted it. I listen to it now. All it says is this. Cody, what do you need from me? Words can have so many meanings. That question could be harboring exasperation, annoyance, guilt, surrender. I listen once more. This time I let myself truly hear that familiar growl of fear and concern and tenderness behind his words. Cody, what do you need from me? And so I tell him.
Chapter 31. Ben offers to come pick me up at home, but I don't want him to come here. We arranged to meet in Yakima, outside the Greyhound station, at noon on Saturday. Then I call Stoner Richard.
Cody, long time no hear. What's the latest and greatest?
What are you doing Saturday night?
Are you asking me out? He teases.
Actually, I'm asking if I can sleep with you, I tease back, before explaining that I'm heading out on a road trip and need a place to crash Saturday night in Boise.
There's always room at the Zeller homestead. Just be prepared. If you come for a Saturday night, the Rev might want you to do things the Jerry way on Sunday.
Okay, I say. Not sure what the Jerry way means, but figuring it's some Jerry Garcia reference. Also, there's a slight catch.
Isn't there always?
Ben McAllister's going to be with me. I hear Richard inhale sharply, either in dismay, or he could be taking a bong hit.
Are you and him? Are you guys?
No, nothing like that. I haven't even talked to him in more than a month. He's just helping me out.
Helping you out? I'll bet he is.
It's not like that. It's about Meg.
Oh.
Richard's voice goes serious. So, can you put us up? We're leaving here around noon, so we should get there around 6 or 7?
Easily. Speed limit's 75 on I-84, but no one goes slower than 80. You'll make good time.
So it's okay for us both to stay?
There's always room in Reverend Jerry's manger, Richard jokes. We're used to having lost souls camped on the floor. For you, we might even scrounge up a couch.
The floor is fine,
so long as it's a separate floor from McAllister.
I wait until Friday night to tell Tricia that I'm going. I've already canceled my Monday and Tuesday cleaning jobs, figuring I'll be back by Tuesday night at the latest. I don't know why I'm nervous about telling her. She gives me a long look. Where are you going? Trisha doesn't keep me on a leash, but if I tell her, it'll wind up right back with the Garcias, and I don't want them to know anything until I have something solid, something helpful. Also, if I tell her, I'm scared that Trisha, even hands-off Trisha, won't let me go. Tacoma, I say. Again? Alice invited me down. I thought she was in Montana. I should have learned my lesson from all my dealings with all underscore BS. The safest way to lie is to shadow the truth. She is. She's going home for the weekend, I reply, hoping Trisha doesn't remember that Alice is actually from Eugene. Trisha eyes me again. I'll be back Monday night, Tuesday latest, I add. You need me to clean any of your houses? I shake my head. Some messes can wait. I can't sleep at all Friday night, so Saturday morning I pack a few things, my box full of cash, which now totals $560, my computer, and my maps, and catch the first bus to Yakima. I arrive at 9:30 and plant myself at a depressing coffee shop near the bus station, spreading my maps in front of me. It's a straight 1,000-mile shot from here to Laughlin, cutting a triangle through Oregon and another through Idaho, before shooting down the eastern spine of Nevada. The waitress keeps refilling my coffee cup, and I keep drinking, even though the burnt swill is doing awful things to the acid in my stomach, not to mention my frayed nerves. For the past 24 hours, I've done nothing but second-guess the decision to call Ben. The door to the diner rings. I look up absent-mindedly, and am surprised to see it's him. It's only 10:30. He's not due for another hour and a half, and it's a 2 to 3 hour drive from Seattle, so he must have left at the crack of dawn, or sped like the devil, or both. My first impulse is to hunch down in my seat, buy myself more time. But I'm about to spend 2 days cramped in a car with him, so I man up. I clear my throat and say, "Hey, Ben." His face goes blank for a second, and then his eyes skitter around until he sees me in my booth, the maps splayed out. He looks both nervous and relieved. And once again, his face is like a mirror, reflecting my feelings, because that's exactly what's going on with me. He sits down across from me. "You're early," he says. "So are you." I slide my coffee over to him. "You want some?" "She just refilled it, so it's fresh. Or fresh to my cup, anyhow." His fingers curl around the cup of coffee, which is black, no sugar. The same as he likes it, I now remember. I take him in. His eyes are violet this morning, almost bruised. They match the purplish skin under them. "I couldn't sleep," he says. "Seems to be going around," I say. He nods. "So what's the plan?" "Drive to Boise today. We can stay with Stoner Richard. I mean, Richard Zeller. You remember Meg's roommate?" "I remember." "He said we could crash at his place. It's his parents. Unless you want to stay somewhere else. He probably has plenty of places to stop. Plenty of rock and roll crash pads." "I'll go where you go." A simple statement that feels like a blanket. "You going to tell me what it is we're doing?" he asks. When I called Ben, I told him I'd found a person linked to Meg's death and needed someone to come with me while I talked to him. I hadn't told him anything else. I figured he didn't need, nor would he want, to know what had happened in these past few weeks when we'd been absent from each other's lives. But now that he's asking, I'm scared to tell. Harry sent me a few cautioning emails with links to articles about girls meeting guys they'd met online and gruesome things happening. I appreciated his concern, but wasn't sure it was applicable. Those were girls with romantic hopes, guys with depraved intentions. That isn't me and Bradford. But what if Ben doesn't see it that way? What if I tell him and he chickens out? What if he refuses to take me?
When I don't answer right away, Ben asks, "Am I on a need-to-know basis or something?" "No, I shake my head. "It's a long drive."
"What does that mean?"
"There's time. I'll tell you. Later. I promise." I pause. "How are the kids?" I ask.
"I brought pictures,"
he says, and I expect him to show me on his phone, but he pulls out one of those envelopes you get from a photo developer and slides it across the maps to me. I open it up, and inside are a few snapshots, Pete and Repeat chasing a piece of string, washing each other's faces, curled up sleeping together at the foot of Ben's bed. "They're so much bigger," Ben nods.
"Teenagers. Pete brought home a dead mouse. I'm sure it's a gateway thing. It's only a matter of time before they're bringing home all sorts of animals.
Birds. Rats.
Then it's possums. Then small ponies. I wouldn't put it past those two."
I laugh. It feels like the first time in ages. I hand the photos back. Ben shakes his head.
"They're for you."
"Oh. Thanks. Do you want something to eat before we go?" Ben shakes his head.
"I came to kill time while I was waiting for you."
"And here I am."
"Here you are."
The awkward silence that follows doesn't bode well for the next 2 days. "Should we get going?" I ask.
"Okay. I should warn you. The cigarette lighter outlet for the iPod is acting up, so the music situation is precarious."
"I'll deal."
"Also, less important to me, but maybe not you, the AC's kind of on the blink, which is going to make Nevada desert driving in July rather interesting."
"We'll just stop at gas stations and douse ourselves with water and leave the windows open. It's what Meg and I used to do." And then I stop myself. Everything spools back to Meg. Every piece of my history, it seems.
"Sounds like a plan,"
Ben says. We head outside. He unlocks his car. It's remarkably clean compared to the last time I was in it. "Do you want me to drive first?" I ask. "Or don't you let girls drive your car?"
"I don't make a habit of letting anyone drive my car." He looks sidelong at me. "But you're not a girl anyway."
"Oh, right. Have you categorized my species yet?"
"Not quite."
He tosses me the keys.
"But you can drive."
As soon as we hit the interstate, I relax. I got my license when I was 16, but I so rarely get to actually drive anywhere. I forget how freeing it is to just have open road in front of you and wind in your hair, with the windows down and the stereo on. It's too loud to talk much, and that's fine. Ben can't ask me about Bradford, can't ask me about the last month, and can't mention the kiss either. Outside of Baker City, we stop for lunch at a place Ben knows. I'm skeptical about a Chinese restaurant in the middle of redneck eastern Oregon, but Ben says the dumplings are the best he's ever had. It seems like he's been here a lot. The young waitress clearly knows him and keeps finding excuses to come by the table to refill our tea and talk to him, until her stern mother comes out from the kitchen and shoos her away. "Wow. You know everyone on the I-84 corridor?" I ask him.
"Just in the Chinese restaurants. Along I-5, too."
I motion toward the waitress, who is smiling at him. "Is she a fan from when you came through here with one of your bands?" Ben gives me a look.
"I was never here with a band. I ate here with my little sister Bethany."
That name is familiar. And then I remember that was one of the girls Ben was talking to on the phone when I went to see him in Seattle that first time. "Bethany is your little sister?" He nods.
"Yeah. She was having a tough time at home. Back then I was couch surfing in Portland, so I swooped in, all big hero man, to pick her up and take her on a road trip. I was going to take her to Utah, to Zion. I've always wanted to go there."
He swigs his tea.
"Car broke down here. Piece of shit, Pontiac."
"What happened to your road trip? You guys hitch?"
"Nah. Bethany was only 11. Ben shakes his head.
I had to call my stepfather to come get her, and we hung out here while he drove up. He was so pissed at me that he refused to give me a lift back to Bend. I didn't have anything going in Portland, so I wound up hitching to Seattle. That's how I landed there.
Oh. It's not exactly the rock star chasing his dreams story. Where is she now? Bethany.
Ben's eyes go flat. There.
I'm not exactly sure where there is, but by the way he says it, I know it's not a place he'd want to be.
Let's finish up and get back on the road, he suggests. You know, Chinese food means we'll be hungry again in an hour.
Ha! We only have a couple of hours till Boise, and Richard texted to say that they're grilling tonight.
Ben perks up. Grilling? Like real meat? Nothing tofu?
I text Richard back to ask if there will be tofu, and he texts me back a puking emoticon.
You're safe, I tell Ben.
We gas up and Ben takes the wheel, and it's only when we get into the car and back on the interstate that I notice Ben didn't smoke after lunch. In fact, he hasn't smoked the whole time we've been on the road.
If you're not smoking for my benefit, don't worry about it, I tell him. But then I notice that the car doesn't smell like an ashtray the way it did before.
Ben smiles kind of bashfully. He lifts up the sleeve of his shirt to show me a flesh-colored patch.
I quit.
When?
A few weeks ago.
Why?
Aside from the fact that cigarettes are deadly and expensive?
He asks. Right. Aside from that. Ben slices the quickest of looks my way before turning his attention back to the road.
I guess I needed a change.
By 6 o'clock, we are in the outskirts of Boise, the tilting early evening sun making the foothills surrounding the city go red. I pull out the directions that Richard emailed me and guide Ben through the downtown and out past the military area to a pretty tree-lined street with sprawling ranch houses. We stop in front of one with an overflowing orange bougainvillea bush and a big white van in the driveway. This is it, I tell Ben. As we knock on the front door, I kick myself. We should have brought something, some kind of gift or something. That's the kind of thing you're supposed to do. Too late now. No one answers. We ring the bell. Still nothing. People are home. There's a TV on and there's a sound of voices inside. We knock again. Still no answer. I'm about to text Richard when Ben opens the door and sticks his head inside.
Hello?
He calls. A kid bounds up, a huge grin zigzagging across her face, which is sort of messed up by a cleft palate or one of those things you see in those TV commercials asking for money. Maybe we have the wrong house, I whisper. But then the kid shouts,
Richard, your friends are here!
And 5 seconds later, Richard ambles over, scoops the girl up, and ushers us inside.
This is Cece, he says,
tickling the girl under her arms as she screams in delight. He points around the room to where 3 more kids are sitting on beanbags and cushions, watching a movie.
That's Jack, Pedro, and Tally.
Hi, I say.
Hey, Ben says. Toy Story?
3,
Pedro says. Ben nods knowingly.
Who are they?
I whisper to Richard as he sets Cece down.
Family 2.0, Richard says.
Huh?
They're my brothers and sisters, the second string, though really more like first string. My other brother Gary is out back, and my sister Lisa is currently in Uganda, working with orphans or something extremely noble.
He slides open the glass door leading out to the patio. Only then does he acknowledge Ben.
Ben, he says cautiously. Rich,
Ben says back.
Thanks for having us. Having her. You're just along for the ride.
Out back, 2 men are arguing over the grill, while a woman with cut-off shorts and a cute halter top stands in the kiddie pool, watching them bemusedly.
You'll let me know when to bring out the corn, she calls.
Then she sees us.
Jerry, Richard's friends are here.
She climbs out of the pool and comes to introduce herself. I'm Sylvia,
You must be Cody. And you must be Ben.
Thank you so much for having us, I say.
And having us for a barbecue, Ben says, eyeing the grill lustfully.
We'll only have a barbecue if these mountain goats can stop arguing about what wood to smoke with, Sylvia says.
Pop, Richard calls.
Richard's dad is very tall, so tall he's stooped, as if he's spent his entire life bending down to listen to other people.
Hello, he says in a quiet voice. Thank you for joining us tonight.
I hope we're not imposing. Sylvia laughs.
As you can see, the term full house is relative around here.
We think Pop is going for 12 kids in all so he can have his own gang of disciples, Richard's brother Gary says.
Inherent in the word disciple is some sort of discipline of following one's father, which is a far cry from what goes on here, Richard's dad jokes. He looks at me and Ben.
We're having ribs tonight. The boys and I are disagreeing over hickory or mesquite to smoke with. Perhaps you have an opinion.
Either's fine, I begin.
Mesquite, Ben says emphatically.
Richard and his brother fist bump.
Smartest thing I've ever heard you say, Richard tells Ben.
Richard,
Sylvia admonishes.
Mesquite it is, Jerry says, throwing up his hands in good-natured surrender. We'll eat in about 2 hours. Richard, why don't you take your road-weary guests inside and offer them something to drink?
Richard raises an eyebrow.
A cold soda, his father says.
There's some lemonade, too, Sylvia says.
The monsters drank it all, Richard says.
So squeeze some more. We have a ton of lemons.
When life gives you lemons, Richard begins.
Then he looks at me for a second and stops himself, like he thinks it's wrong to make this joke in front of me. I'm not sure why now, all of a sudden, he should get shy in front of me. So I finish for him. Make lemonade. Dinner is late and chaotic and delicious. 10 of us crammed around a picnic table under a clear Idaho sky. Ben eats so many ribs that even Richard is impressed, and when Ben explains that he lives in a vegan household, Sylvia throws a few hot dogs on the grill to top him off. I look at this nearly emaciated man and wonder how he can possibly pack it all away. But he does. 2 more hot dogs and a pair of ice cream sandwiches from the Costco box that comes out after dinner. It's past 9 when Sylvia and Jerry begin the epic undertaking of bathing and putting to bed all the hyped-up little ones. Gary heads out to meet some friends. Richard throws some logs on a fire pit in the back of the yard and sneaks into the garage for a couple of beers. Through the window, I can see Richard's dad, a picture book open, reading to a bunch of kids in bunk beds. I hear the clatter of Sylvia doing dishes. Over the flickering firelight, I catch Ben's eye, and I swear we are thinking the same thing. How lucky some people are. I'm hit with a sudden wave of aching nostalgia. I miss this. But how can I miss this when I never truly had it in the first place? It was secondhand through Meg, like pretty much everything else in my life. The firelight crackles. Richard finishes his beer and stashes the empty in the bushes. You want another? He asks us. Ben shakes his head.
Better not. We have a big drive tomorrow.
He looks at me. I nod.
So, where are you going exactly? Richard asks Ben.
Ben looks at me, asking the same silent question. I still haven't told him the whole story. Laughlin, Nevada.
I caught that much, Richard replies.
He goes to the cooler and grabs another beer for himself and a couple of Dr. Peppers for Ben and me. Something in my chest twists, and it's ridiculous, because I'm getting emotional, because he remembered what soft drink I like.
I guess my question is really, why Laughlin?
I don't say anything. Neither does Ben.
What, is it a secret or something? Richard asks. Ben looks at me.
Apparently.
Wait, you don't know? Richard says.
I'm just along for the ride, Ben fires back.
They glare at each other for a second and then look at me. Inside, Jerry and the kids are saying prayers, calling out a long list of people to be blessed.
This is between us,
I say, pointing back and forth between me and Richard and Ben.
A sacred circle, Richard jokes, or triangle, a ménage à silence.
I give him a look, and then he goes solemn and promises. Remember when I came down and Harry was helping me with the computer thing? I ask. Richard nods. We found an encrypted file on Meg's computer, and it turned out that it was instructions from this suicide support group. A group that supports your decision to end your own life. I did some more digging, and I uncovered her posting to these discussion boards. There was this one guy. He was like her mentor. He encouraged her.
That's messed up, Richard says.
Yeah, it is, I say.
I can't believe Meg fell for it.
I know, I say. But I lack the conviction on this one. Because now that I know Bradford, I can believe it. So I found this guy. And now I'm going to see him.
You're what?
Ben interjects. I'm going to see him, I repeat, but it comes out tepid this time.
I thought you needed to talk to someone who knew about her death, like the Seattle people, Ben exclaims. He frowns at me like I violated some treaty.
I take a deep breath to keep my voice level. I'm talking to the person who caused her death.
Except she caused her death, Richard says. That's the definition of suicide.
Richard and I glare at each other. Bradford made her do it.
Which makes going to see him a brilliant idea, Ben fumes. You knew I was looking for him,
I shoot back.
I don't know shit, Cody, because for the last 6 weeks you've refused to talk to me.
I'm talking to you now. I spent the last 6 weeks trying to smoke this guy out.
And how'd you do that?
Richard asks, his gaze ping-ponging between Ben and me. Harry helped, but mostly it was me. I kind of posed as someone who was suicidal. You know, me, appetizing mouse. Him, hungry snake.
Jesus fucking Christ, Cody, Ben exclaims. Are you insane?
You mean like Meg was? That shuts him up.
How does one do that? Pose as suicidal,
Richard asks.
My only experience is the opposite. Someone suicidal posing is okay.
I could bullshit. I could say I lied, made it all up. But I tell the truth. I found the part in me that was tired of living, I say quietly. And I put her out there. I look down, unable to face their shock or anger or disgust. I suppose that does make me insane. I sneak a peek at Ben, but he's staring hard at the fire.
Nah, Richard says. Everyone goes there. Everyone has their days. Everyone imagines it. But you know why my pop says that suicide is a sin?
He points his thumb toward the house, where Jerry is now helping Sylvia with the rest of the dishes. Because it's murder? Because only God can choose when it's your time to go? Because stealing a life is stealing from God? I parrot all the awful things people said about Meg. Richard shakes his head.
No. Because it kills hope. That's the sin. Anything that kills hope is a sin.
I chew on that for a while.
So, what do you expect to accomplish now that you've found this guy?
Ben asks in a strangely formal tone. He has to be liable, somehow, as an accessory or something. So call the cops, Ben says. It's not that simple, I say.
Have you told Meg's family?
He asks. You're missing the point, I reply.
None of this will bring her back, Richard says. You know that, right?
Yes, I know that. That's not the point either, though the point is muddled. But I can't go to the cops or go to Meg's family. I have to do this, do something by myself. For Meg. And for me.
Chapter 32. I wake up the next morning to the International Coalition of Zeller Children leaping onto the couch. I get up, get dressed, and I'm helping Sylvia with the toaster waffles when Ben pads out, rubbing his eyes. Want to get coffee on the road? I ask him. You're leaving already? Sylvia asks. I make apologies, say we should get out of their hair, but Sylvia says we're no trouble. And it's Sunday.
Services start at 10, Richard says, coming out in a cleanish-looking pair of jeans and a T-shirt with no drug references on it. Can't you stay? The Rev will be bummed otherwise.
I glance at Ben, who hasn't spoken to me since last night. He shrugs the question back to me. I look at Richard and Sylvia and realize it doesn't matter if I brought a gift. This is what matters. I look down at my cut-off shorts and tank top. I'd better change.
You can if you want, Sylvia says, but wear a come-as-you-are congregation.
We caravan over at 9:30. Richard driving with me and Ben, the rest of the family in the van, which has one of those coexist bumper stickers on it. Outside the church, the various Zeller children are scooped up by different congregants, and Sylvia and Jerry go into greeter mode. Richard slips inside with Ben and me. We take our seats. The pews are a little worn, and it smells slightly of cooking oil. It's the dumpiest of the churches I've been to, and this past year I've been to a lot. Before that, I hardly went to church at all. Meg's first communion, and the occasional midnight mass. Trisha usually works late Saturday nights, and Sundays are reserved for worshiping the pillow. The service here is unlike any I've been to. There's no choir. Instead, different people get up and sing and play guitar or piano, and anyone can join in. Some of the songs are religious, but others aren't. Ben's all pleased when a bearded guy plays a soulful tune called I Feel Like Going Home. He leans over and tells me it's by Charlie Rich, one of his favorite artists. It's the first normal thing he said to me since we argued last night. I take it as a peace offering. It's beautiful, I tell him. Jerry sort of stays out of the way for much of the proceedings, allowing a younger guy who leads the youth ministry to run the show. And then, when all the singing is over and announcements have been made, he uncurls himself from his seat where he's been sitting calmly, and in a voice that is quiet, but somehow commanding, steps to the pulpit and starts talking.
A few weeks ago, Cece was sick. She had a fever, was sluggish, that bug that's been going around. I know a lot of us went through it.
There is some murmuring and tongue-clucking in the congregation.
Pedro didn't have school that day, so he had to tag along with us to the doctor's. Cece doesn't like doctor's offices, having been to so many of them. So she was agitated and crying. And the longer we waited, the worse it got. And we were waiting a while. An hour went by. Then an hour and a half. Cece kept crying, and then she threw up. Mostly on me. There's sympathetic laughter. I'm still not sure if it was because of the virus, or because she had gotten herself so worked up about being at the doctor. Doesn't matter. But this one mother sitting with her own daughter visibly flinched at Cece's mess. and then she chastised me for exposing all the other children to her. On some level, I got it. None of us wants our kids to be sick. But as a father, I was livid. In my head, I said many unchristian things about that woman. To that woman. Cece being sick was the point of our being in the pediatrician's office in the first place. And this was not a Christian way to behave. The nurses were too busy to offer much help aside from giving us some wipes and sanitizer. All the while, Cece kept crying. Eventually, I got her cleaned up and she fell asleep. Pedro found a puzzle, and with a few seconds to spare, I picked up a magazine. It was 2 years out of date, this being a doctor's office. I opened to a random page. It was an article about forgiveness. Now, this wasn't a religious publication. It was a medical journal. And the article was describing a study that had analyzed all the health benefits of forgiveness. Apparently, it lowers blood pressure, decreases anxiety, minimizes depression. I understood then that I'd been sent this article on purpose. As I read it, I thought of Colossians chapter 3, verse 13. Bear with each other, and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And so I forgave everyone in that room. The woman for being so rude. The nurses for being too busy to help. The doctor for keeping us waiting. Even Cece for her histrionics. And then, I forgave myself. As soon as I did, my worry over Cece eased. I felt calm, peaceful, and full of love. And in that moment, I was reminded just why God wants us to forgive. Not simply because it's the key to a better world, but because of what it does for ourselves. Forgiveness is God's gift to us. Christ forgave us. He forgave our sins. That was His gift. But by allowing us to forgive each other, He opened us up to that divine love. The article had it right. Forgiveness. It's a miracle drug. It's God's miracle drug. Jerry goes on, quoting more lines from Scripture about forgiveness. But at the moment, I'm just not feeling it. Last night I went to bed first, leaving Ben and Richard around the fire. Those two barely tolerate each other, so I figured they'd call it a night soon after. But now, as Richard's father goes on, I can see that's not what happened. Tongues went wagging. So much for a sacred circle. Jerry continues, after we saw the doctor, I was settling up at the front desk and I ran into the angry mother again. All the rancor I'd felt was gone. There was no effort to rise above. It just vanished. I told her that I hoped her little girl was feeling better. She turned to look at me. I could now recognize how tired she was, like so many of us parents are. "She'll be fine," she said. The doctor said she's healing well. I looked at the little girl and saw a small welt, red, still fresh on her chin. I turned back to the mother and saw something much fresher there. Anguish. Not nearly so well healed. I wanted to ask her what happened, but Pedro and Cece were yanking to go. And besides, it wasn't my place. But I suppose she needed to unburden herself, because she told me how a few weeks earlier she'd been rushing to get out the door in the morning, but her little girl had been dawdling by the flowers. She'd yanked her by the hand, and the girl, still busy watching the bees dancing, had slammed into a gate. That's how she'd gotten the cut. She'll always carry that scar, the mother told me, in a voice pinched with agony. And then, I understood her anger. Just who it was she hadn't forgiven. She will, only if you do, I told her back. She looked at me, and I knew what I was asking her to do. What God asks us to do. What I'm asking you all to do isn't easy. To let our scars heal. To forgive. And hardest of all sometimes is to forgive ourselves. But if we don't, we're squandering one of God's greatest gifts, His miracle cure. When the sermon ends, Richard turns to me, grinning almost. He seems so proud of his father or himself for orchestrating this public service announcement. What'd you think? I don't answer. I just push my way out of the pew. What's wrong? Ben asks. What's wrong is that Richard Zeller and his dad don't know what the hell they're talking about. They don't know about the mornings when anger is the one thing, the only thing, to get you through the day. If they take that from me, I'm wide open, raw and gaping. And then I don't stand a fucking chance. I go to the lobby, holding back tears of rage. Richard is right behind me. Couldn't take the rev anymore? He jokes, but there's worry in his eyes. You told him. You said you wouldn't, and you told him. You lied. I didn't even see my dad until breakfast, and you were right there. Then how'd he know? How'd he have such a perfect sermon waiting? Richard glances toward the sanctuary, where the singing has started up again. For the record, Cody, he works on his sermons for weeks in advance. He doesn't pull them out of his ass. Also, for the record, you're not the only one with a chip on her shoulder and some crap to forgive. But if, like the Rev says, the magazine opens to the right page... Are you stoned? I interrupt. This makes him laugh. I didn't tell the Rev about your trip. If you want to know the truth, I had to talk McAllister out of turning around. You've got bigger balls than him. No surprise there. The singing ends. Richard nods toward the pulpit. Come on back. It's almost over. Please. I follow Richard back to our row, right as Jerry is offering up blessings for the congregation, for the sick and the grieving, for those getting married, expecting babies. Right at the very end, he says, And may God bless and guide Cody and Ben. May they find not just what they're looking for, but what they need. I look at Richard again. I'm not entirely sure that he's telling the truth about not saying something to his father. But right now, the betrayal, if there was one, feels less important than the benediction.
Chapter 33. Outside the church, Ben tosses me the keys, like he knows that I need to drive. At Twin Falls, we cut off the interstate onto Highway 93. Ben starts yawning, his eyes drooping. He camped on the floor of Richard and Gary's room, and he says between Richard snoring and Gary talking in his sleep, he didn't get much rest. Why don't you take a nap? I suggest. He shakes his head.
Goes against the code.
What code?
Touring code. Someone always has to stay up with the driver.
That makes sense if there's a bunch of you, but there's only two of us, and you're tired. He looks at me, considering. Look, I go on, we can just make up a new code. He continues to look at me, but then he gives in. He turns his face toward the window and falls asleep, staying that way for the next 3 hours. There's something nourishing about seeing him sleep. Maybe it's the sun, or maybe my imagination. But the bluish tinge from underneath his eye seems to fade a bit. He sleeps until the highway ends,
and I pull into a